From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. The prison population is rising, and the incarceration rate for women is rising twice as fast as men. The result is an eightfold increase in the overall number of women in jail, and the recidivism rates for female inmates have increased sharply as well. Experts blame the rise on a number of factors, including the sentencing structure, a lack of rehabilitation programs in prisons, welfare and aid restrictions for inmates, and a population of women likely to have abusive relationships outside. Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project, a public policy think tank in Washington. He has researched the issues surrounding women and the justice system and joins us now from his office in Washington, D.C. Hello, Mark.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Thank you very much. We welcome your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862. If you've had contact with the prison system, if you know about it, give us a call at 877-962-9862. We're talking today about recidivism and the increase in the prison population among women. How severe is the increase, Mark?
And over Well, it's quite dramatic. The latest figures from the Justice Department show that there are now more than 100,000 women in our state and federal prisons. If you add local jails, we're very close to 200,000 women behind bars now. And over the last 20 years, while women represent a relatively small proportion of all people in prison, their rate of increase is nearly double that for men. So it's a very dramatic change in a relatively short period of time that we've been seeing in recent years.
And what's going on?
Well, I think even more so than for men, the story is one of the war on drugs, that since the mid-1980s, drug offenses have been the single largest factor explaining the growth of the prison system. Overall, we went from a point in 1980 with about 40,000 people in prison and jail for a drug offense. Today, that figure is almost 500,000 just in 25-year period. And for women, it's even more true than for men. Essentially, today, about a third of the women in prison are incarcerated for drug offense, and this compares to about one-fifth for men. And that's only a specific drug offense, drug use, drug sales, possession. If we thought of the category of drug-related offenses, women committing economic or property crimes as a result of a drug addiction or so, the figures are likely to be well over half of the women who are behind bars. So it's a question of drug policy and how that's approached and whether that's a criminal justice problem or more of a community problem.
Why would drug policy affect women disproportionately, though? Especially when we're talking about a 25-year period then, we're talking about going back to 1980 or so.
Yeah. Right? Well, yeah. I think in a couple of ways. One is overall in terms of drug policy, there's some fundamental questions about whether we approach it through the court system or is more a community issue in a preventive way. And essentially, I think we've invested enormous funds. About two-thirds of the funds in the war on drugs have gone to law enforcement incarceration and just one-third to prevention and treatment. So the overall thrust of the war on drugs has been very much a law enforcement approach. I think for women, the issue has become even more acute for a couple of reasons. One is that many treatment programs have not been established with the needs of women in mind, particularly the fact that most women are mothers and have young children, and you need to incorporate some means of dealing with that through a treatment program, and what's going to happen with the kids and how do women deal with those issues. Women are also less likely than men to be involved in violent offenses, so when they are, we do see an increase in their prison figures. It's much more likely it's going to result in the drug expansion, too. As the system has expanded and targeted drug offenses, women have been much more likely than in previous times to get caught up in that.
And if it's a drug offense, then it's likely, I suppose, that this may explain part of the reason that the recidivism rate or the rate at which women return to prison is increasing as well.
Well, certainly there's a lot to that. Whether it's drug offenses or drug-related offenses, if we assume that women are going to prison because the underlying problem is a drug addiction or substance abuse, then clearly what needs to happen is that we need to address that while in prison and make good use of that time. Unfortunately, what we see, and this is, again, true for both women and men, as the prison population has expanded so dramatically, the programming in prison has never kept up with that increased demand, if you will, so that the average person today in prison who's got a substance abuse problem is actually less likely to be receiving treatment of that problem than he or she would have 15 years ago. So we've got more people going, but actually proportionally less a chance to address
less chance,
issues.
Fewer resources. Well, our own Leonid Inge has done some reporting on at least one program designed to help women who are in prison make it on the way, make it when they get out. Leonid Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, and has been covering this issue in the prisons. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the program that you studied in North Carolina prisons.
Well, the program is called Job Start, and I know that may not seem like the name of a program to help someone through their drug addiction or the problems that they've had, but what a lot of folks are finding out that, you know, if you can sort of transition the lives of women from prison back into society, it'll have a great success of doing well, maybe if they had a job, you know, something they could hold on to or something that could help them take care of themselves. So that's the program that I looked at. It's been going on about 5 years, and women have to fill out applications to actually show their interest, that they're willing to be dedicated to such a program. And right now, for adults, I guess it's just the women at one of the minimum security prison in Raleigh. So the women come from there, and then they go to actually First Presbyterian Church in Raleigh, and there's a special space there for them where they meet on a daily basis.
You get a sense of how many women or what percentage of women could be helped by this program?
Well, I guess in the last 5 years, only about 40 women have gone through this program. And, of course, that sounds teeny when you think of the scope of things, how many women are actually going into prison. But they're very selective and actually have to, you know, weed out women who are very serious. You know, sometimes I guess the attitude when I speak to the director of this program, you know, if you can just help a good small few that may be able to help others, you know, that means they go back to the prison and people see they've changed and maybe their story, their lives would be better by the program. So then maybe they'll apply next time. But in 5 years, I think only 40 women have gone through the program, only about 8 or so women per session. And they're there for 6 hours a day. You know, they get picked up from the minimum security prison, taken downtown. And for 6 hours, they get to bond. They get to talk about their lives. And, of course, they keep a diary. And they get to meet people who can actually help them get a job when they get out of prison.
Any sense of how successful the program has been in keeping women from returning to prison?
Well, we know that recidivism rate is very bad, and usually people who was very high, rather. And if someone is going to return to prison, they usually do it in the first 3 years. But in this program so far, I'm told only about 10% of the women have, gone back to prison or somehow kind of dropped off. You know, they don't know where they are. Maybe they've gone back to their old ways, but they're not in prison, I guess, yet. But they're not keeping in contact with the group. So right now, actually, that program, Job Start, it's run by a lady named Alice Noel from the area. She's actually tracking the women over 3 years just to make sure they are doing well. What are they doing if they're working, if they're back with their families, if they're in school or whatever?
We are talking today about the recidivism rate among women and the high incarceration rate, the growing rate among women, with Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., and Leonid Inge here at WUNC. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Dan is in the Outer Banks. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a situation very related to the first gentleman's comments about the drug situation and the use or abuse or selling or whatever it might be is still drug related. Right. And my comment is that when the population is so maxed out in the prisons that they give all these ladies probation periods when they go to court for these offenses. My girlfriend is in jail, and she was put on probation for her offense first, which was a 12-month period. And during that time, there was almost no attempt to rehabilitate her or to give her any kind of counseling or any programming. She was simply supposed to report into a probation officer once a week and be home every night and, you know, random drug tests. And, you know, how they expect to keep them off the drugs when they're just simply, you know, slap them on the wrist and put them right back in society And then, you know, 8-10 months go by, and they violated their probation rules a few times, and then they revoke them. Now she's got to go do 12 months in jail after 10 months of probation because of a lack of a good system to get them off the drugs before they go to jail.
Well, thanks for that, Dan. Mark Maurer, how typical is that?
Well, unfortunately, it's far too typical. You know, there certainly are some people for whom, you know, just supervision on probation is fine. It's sufficient to control their behavior, and they don't need more than that. But for an awful lot of people, particularly those who have a substance abuse problem, you don't want to set people up to fail in the community while they're on probation. So while they're there, yes, you want to do drug testing, but you also want to get them involved in programming to deal with that underlying abuse, because otherwise we're just kind of kidding ourselves. We don't put the resources in, and then, as we hear, people end up violating, going back to prison anyway. Part of the problem, I think, is really a vicious cycle, as we've invested so much in prison. Prison costs in the range of $25,000 a year to keep a person for 1 year. We kind of starve resources from programs of probation and parole that should be supervising people in the community, and so the probation officer is left to have people come in a couple times a month or so, do a drug test, and in far too many cases, that's all there is. And it's a real vicious cycle that I think we need to try to interrupt in policy terms.
We are going to continue our conversation on the state of things, talking about women and the justice system, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Mark Maurer is my guest from the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., Leonita Inge of WUNC. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. We're talking about women in the justice system in North Carolina with Leonita Inge and Mark Maurer, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We've been talking, Mark, about and Leonita, about the programs available for women, and you're suggesting that there may not be enough. What about sentencing? Sentencing guidelines and mandatory sentencing, how much of an impact, Mark, has that had on the increase that we're looking at?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's been a very substantial part as well, particularly the impact of mandatory sentencing. The new generation of mandatories came about in the mid to late 1980s along with the war on drugs, and so mandatories are often applied specifically to drug offenses, and overall what they do is take a sort of one-size-fits-all approach to sentencing. And the problem with that, of course, is that, you know, you can have two drug offenders. One is a kingpin flying in drugs by the plane load, and the other is a college student who sells drugs one time to an undercover agent. Both of them are going to be punished in court, but I think it would seem to most people that the punishment should look very different based on their levels of culpability and all. And unfortunately, mandatory sentencing, you know, doesn't allow us to make those distinctions. The problem for women is particularly ironic because the only way to get around mandatory sentencing is if you cooperate with a prosecutor in giving information. Well, there are countless numbers of cases where you get a sort of boyfriend, big-time drug dealer. His girlfriend is sort of going along for the ride and helping him. The boyfriend has information to trade with the prosecutor, maybe able to avoid the mandatory. The girlfriend doesn't necessarily know anybody except the boyfriend. So ironically, she does more time in prison than he does, even though he's clearly more responsible.
She's a little lower on the food chain when it comes to drug offenses.
Exactly.
in the drug world. Leonita, let's talk about the women themselves. One of the complications, it seems, is that when women come out, they're often providing not only for themselves but a family. And if they're still addicted to drugs, this is going to be a pretty serious problem.
Yes, it is. And sometimes just the stress that a woman would feel when she has that kind of responsibility, you know, may be too much to bear. For some of them, I know we spoke earlier about, you know, when the gentleman called, you know, where do these women go for help? How come the system isn't helping them? Well, we know for a fact, you know, there are more people in the system, like Mark said, than there used to be, but the programs haven't increased with that. But what I've noticed is that I guess the different churches have had to step up, and they are stepping up. You know, you have different missions that actually, you know, provide services to women. They may pick them up or provide them with clothes. you know, counseling, whatever they can do. And that's what I found even with the JobStart program, even though, you know, it's a program about getting them back to a level where they can enter society and take care of themselves. But, you know, who ended up providing, you know, probably funds and resources and a space, you know, the church, the Presbyterian yeah. Church. And then there's some mission homes and some halfway houses or transition homes that also churches in this state, I know, provide for women to help them with that transition.
Mark Maurer, are there model programs, if you talk about, if there were more resources available or more resources put to this problem, how should they be spent? Would it be drug rehabilitation, job training? How do you see it working?
Yeah, well, I think we probably want to work at a couple of levels. First, of course, is, you know, anyone who's got a drug program in the community, a problem, and wants help, you know, we should have treatment programs available for all those who need it, so we don't need to resort to the court system. There are some prison models that do very interesting work. In New York State, Bedford Hills is a long-standing prison for women with a long-time, very creative warden, and there they draw on enormous resources from the community. For one thing, women with newborn children can actually have their newborns with them in the prison for up to 18 months just to develop that relationship with their child and to learn parenting skills. They also, being located near New York City, they have artists and writers come in doing workshops for the women, enhancing the skills that they can do. And the prison welcomes the community rather than, so often the case, sort of keeping the community out of things. So trying to make those connections with the community in the long run can really make a difference in getting the skills and getting the job contacts that are really critical for success.
Let's go to the phones. Nancy is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work with a program in Raleigh. I volunteer. It's called Harriet's House. It's run by a nonprofit in Raleigh called Passage Home. And one problem in particular that we run into, it's a program that actually women have to be referred to from within prison about 3 months before they get out. And the program will walk them through, will give them a furnished home to live with other women that have been released before them, working with their drug addictions if there is that problem, finding them jobs. They have a full-time case manager. They also have children, and they will help them with that transition. It's about an 18 to 24-month program. But one problem that we run into in particular is NIMBYism. Where do these women, how can we find housing for these women when society is not willing to
Not in my neighborhood is what you mean.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I'd like to hear from your experts on how we as a society can become educated. These women are free to go wherever they want, but they are taking the initiative to help themselves, pull themselves up, and they're not accepted.
Well,
I'd like to hear.
Thanks, Nancy. Leonita, thank you.
Well, one thing I found out with a home where a lady that I followed, where she transitioned to, first of all, the house looks like just one big, beautiful house on that street, you know. But when she entered the house and, you know, unloaded and moved up to her room, there were a few rules outlined for her by the lady who runs that house. And one rule is that they have to go to community meetings in the neighborhood. You know, when they're, you know, meetings about anything, crime, garbage, whatever, they have to go to the weekly community meetings. And they also, the very first thing she makes them do is go register and vote. She says that day. She says, if you're not registered, you do it today. Because, you know, just to, you know, show others that they're serious about entering society, they belong in society, and they will be a part. They're taxpayers, they're voters, and, you know, that does count for something.
So you're talking about a woman who has welcomed former inmates into her home or is part
of
a program.
Well, this is part of a program, and it's been there for a while. And those are just some of the house rules. You know, you have to be involved in the community with which they live.
Before they get to that part, Mark, what about the question of stigma and how it affects the ability of folks to reenter society?
Well, it's a huge problem, certainly. You know, you come out of prison and you go to a potential employer and they said, what have you been doing the last 2 years? You've got a gap in your resume. That's very difficult to overcome. And, you know, I think the issue is basically the more communication we can establish with community community, the more we can break down some of those stereotypes. It was an intriguing piece in the New York Times earlier this week about a prison in Minnesota, and actually the prison officials are thinking about building a fence outside the prison now. They haven't had one before, and the community members are actually saying, no, we think they're pretty good neighbors here. And a lot of that has been because there's been a lot of interaction with the community, community residents going in the prison, sharing some recreation facilities, and I think it breaks down the stereotypes where we define people just as a criminal rather than a person who's committed a crime, and to get to understand them and what some of their needs look like.
And what a lot of people don't know in North Carolina, I know there's at least one job placement organization, I think it's Jubilee Jobs, and there are a lot others, but I learned from the Employment Security Commission that, you know, companies get money for hiring prisoners, and I know they do in this state, and it's not probably all businesses or companies that you know, are involved in that, but there is a tax credit for that, and also, you know, some companies get money.
Yeah.
So it's an advantage to give someone who just got out of prison a second chance.
Mark, you and Leonita both have talked about programs that sound like they work or could work. Are these programs networked? Do they know about each other?
Well, I think the good news is that there's increasing attention and support for these programs. You know, 20 years ago, you would have had a hard time finding any innovative program either in prison or in the community. And today, there's certainly a good deal of discussion going, and there's a semi-annual conference around women in prison that brings together both advocates and program personnel. So I think there's much more attention than we saw not too long ago. It still, I think, leaves us far short of where we want to be if we want to have effective programming, but at least I think policymakers have now recognized that this is a group of people that we can't ignore anymore.
One of the more interesting things that I noticed in the statistics about women in prison is the percentage of women who come from abused relationships, either sexually or physically or both. Upwards of nearly 50% of the women who are incarcerated have had some history of abuse. And I wonder what impact that has on their ability to find housing and to, you know, start a life.
Well, it's tremendous, and you know, if you go paint a portrait of the women in prison, it's a very compelling and disturbing portrait of disadvantage. You know, more than half the women have been physically or sexually abused. 3/4 have a history of substance abuse, low educational attainment, few connections with legitimate workforce. So all that comes together, leaving the women with, you know, lots of disadvantages when they go to prison. You know, rarely dealing with those in a constructive way while they're in prison, and coming out and, you know, making it in a job environment that's difficult even for people who've got advantages. So, you know, how to overcome that history of abuse, physical abuse, substance abuse, and all that, you know, is extremely challenging. You know, here and there are programs that directly take that on, and some women have supportive families and communities that are going to get them through. But, you know, the couple of years they may do in prison, you know, is punishment enough? And then on top of that, we've got all these other unaddressed needs that, you know, are very problematic.
Leonita, given what these women face once they're in prison, you've done stories about this, you've looked at some of the programs. Are these women mostly pessimistic? I mean, do they have a sense that things could turn around for them?
Well, the women that I met in this program, they're very optimistic. You should see they keep photo albums of each other and all the people that they've met while they're out in the program. And one woman in particular, she was just released last week, and this was her fourth time in prison. And so, of course, the obvious question is, you know, Angela, you know, what do you think this time? She's like, oh, this time I am ready. She says, I wasn't ready the other times. I wasn't approached by programs. I didn't seek out programs. But this time I am so ready. I mean, she had her brand new North Carolina ID card, and she already had a job lined up, and she was in a transition house. And she said it was Christmas, something to be happy about.
Leonita, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leonita Inge and Mark Maurer, the Executive Director of Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, author Alan Gerganis talks about his new story, 14 Feet of Water in My House. Stay with us.